Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, November 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Nuvance Health. HealthQuest and Western Connecticut Health Network are now Nuvance Health, working together to rethink the healthcare experience and deliver care with patients in mind. NuvanceHealth.org. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Jonah Marshall of St. Peter's Health Partners, a surgeon and medical director of the organization's minimally invasive surgery unit. He is here to discuss urology and robotic surgery. Medical Monday, usually a popular program, so be sure to get your call in early, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org with the number again, 800-348-2551. Dr. Jonah Marshall and your calls coming up after news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and today Dr. Jonah Marshall joins us. Dr. Marshall is a urologic surgeon and the medical director of minimally invasive surgery for St. Peter's Health Partners. He also works at Berkshire Medical Center. Dr. Marshall's specialty is robotic surgery and robotic bladder reconstruction, also known as the neobladder. He also uses the robotic-assisted surgical system for procedures involving the prostate and kidneys. If you have a question today, the number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. I understand our main transmitter at 90.3 is on low power, so I'll yell very loudly for the entire program. That should work. You can also tweet your questions at WAMCVoxPop, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jonah Marshall, welcome.
Thank you very much, Ray. I'd just like to say I've been a longtime listener, a longtime fan. I've been listening for over 40 years.
Wow.
And I'm thrilled to be here today.
40 years. That's amazing. Okay. Well, you have a high tolerance for pain. Good for you. We'll try to make this as painless as possible. This is your first time on the show, yeah?
It is.
Well, you know, I'm very interested in this whole robotic surgery thing, and I know next to nothing about it, which is about the same as most topics here on the program. Before we get into robotic bladder reconstruction and the neobladder, let's just talk about robotic surgery in general. First, why? Why develop it?
So the robotic surgery was developed actually by the armed forces. The whole idea was that they would develop a surgical system so that people who were injured on the battlefield could be operated on by a trauma surgeon without having that trauma surgeon be exposed to mortar shells and artillery. So the idea was that there would be a robot that they could roll into the battlefield that could actually help do the surgery without the surgeon having to be right there.
And how far away would the surgeon be?
Well, so that was part of the problem, was the idea was this could happen remotely over the T1 cables and over the internet. It turns out that there's too much of a delay for that to happen. So when we try to do remote surgery, a few milliseconds in the delay with the robot actually equates to some fairly large complications. So what happens now is that the surgeon actually sits in the operating room with the patient, and there's a short cable that connects the surgeon to the device that is touching the patient.
Well, presumably you are an accomplished surgeon of the more commonly...
open surgery.
Right. Okay. So what is the advantage of robotic surgery?
So what it comes down to truly is patients have less pain, they're in the hospital for a shorter time, and they get back to work a lot quicker.
Why?
Because we can do very complicated things through very tiny incisions. And rather than doing one big incision, which triggers this huge inflammatory cascade leading to a lot of pain, if we make very small incisions, we can put these complicated instruments into the patient's abdomen, into their belly, or any part of the patient, and be able to perform these complicated things that we would normally have to put our hands in to do.
All right. Now, that's the why. Now, the how. Are these, you know, you think of robots, you think of late night TV and a giant, big, metallic, hulking thing. But what are we talking about here?
So basically what happens is we have this robot set up in the operating room, and I press a button and go get coffee and leave.
No, come on. Cut it out.
What actually happens is that there's a device that we dock to the patient. We put these complicated instruments in through these small little tubes called trocars, and then I go and sit at the surgeon console, and I immerse my head in this binocular vision where my eyes are set up on the screen. I put my hands in these little gloves, and then everything that I do over on the side of the patient is mimicked by these miniature instruments inside the patient's body. Everything is magnified 10 times. Everything can be scaled, so I can move my hand 3 inches and the instrument only moves 1 inch, or I can move it a third of a millimeter and the instrument only moves a ninth of a millimeter. And we can scale everything down on great magnification to be able to do extremely complicated procedures through tiny holes.
You know, I've seen my son play video games, and it takes, and then I've tried to play video games, and it takes quite a bit of practice and hand-eye coordination. How do you practice that?
Video games.
Really?
Over and over again.
So,
I mean, that's partly true. I mean, I did grow up playing a lot of video games.
Right.
And, you know, to me, the idea of doing robotic surgery was like playing games, doing something that I loved, but at the same time, truly helping people. I spent years doing cancer research and trying to figure out a way to basically cure cancer in a lab. And then I learned in medical school that if we remove tumors, you could cure cancer on a patient-to-patient basis. And have a much higher success rate than you do in the laboratory. In terms of the training process, there's a rigorous training for robotic surgeons, and it has to go through a number of steps, starting with training modules on the robot, starting with, and then moving to online videos, and then we have cadaver labs that we go through until you get to your training courses as a resident. So there's a long training process that's required, and luckily I was in an excellent training program out at the University of Rochester.
Is there any computer assistance with this, or is this all Dr. Jonah Marshall's brain to his hand inside the glove or whatever it is to the robot? In other words, is there error correction? Say Dr. X wants to make incision X here, and the computer might say, well, that's not a great plan.
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. And the short answer to that is no, it's all based on the surgeon. So we talk about open surgery being surgery 1.0 and laparoscopic surgery. If you have somebody that's had a laparoscopic gallbladder removal or laparoscopic appendix removal, that was surgery 2.0, where we went from big open surgery down to laparoscopic surgery, where we could do simple things. And so robotic surgery, we considered surgery 3.0. We can do really complicated things, such as take out a very complicated tumor from the inside of a kidney and reconstruct the kidney, or take out an entire bladder and reconstruct a bladder, or in other specialties, there's complicated things that we can do. So the next step, so surgery 4.0 is going to be where when we have artificial intelligence, we have the computers looking at the landmarks, looking at the organs inside your body, and basically giving a signal back to the surgeon. That's coming. That's probably a few years away.
Isn't that terrifying to some extent?
You know, yes, but so are self-driving cars.
Okay. And thankfully, I don't see many of those right now. Every now and then you see somebody, you know, there's a self-driving vehicle runs over somebody because he was jaywalking.
So the idea behind the way that we're going to be using robotic surgery, because this is truly a life and death situation, is that when you have a pilot who's landing the airplane, what the pilot's looking at is the pilot is looking at the runway, and the runway is where he has to land the airplane. And the computer is set up so that if the plane starts to veer off the runway just by a few inches or even a few feet, the pilot gets a little ding.
Yeah.
And so it tells him, you know, you're off course, you want to regulate. And it's the same way in surgery. Every time we do surgery, we want to do it perfect.
Right.
We do not want errors. That is the last thing that we want. And so we want to be able to use the technology that's at our fingertips to be able to improve what we're doing.
This is fascinating, and I want to talk about the neobladder, which is something that you specialize in. Dr. Jonah Marshall is our guest of St. Peter's Health Partners. We talk urologic surgery today and robotic surgery, and we'll take a quick break. 800-348-2551 is the phone number. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back. Vox Pop, Medical Monday, Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. We are here with urologic surgeon Dr. Jonah Marshall from St. Peter's Health Partners, and we've been talking a bit about robotic surgery. We'll get to the phones in a moment, but I wanted to ask you about this new thing, and I may not be new by now, but they call it new, the neobladder, which is it's a fake bladder, right?
It is a fake bladder. So for patients who have advanced bladder cancer, where the bladder cancer is invaded into the muscle wall, they're at a very high risk of their cancer coming back. Even if we scrape the tumor out or even if we treat the tumor in the bladder, they're at a very high risk of having bladder cancer return and spread. So what the gold standard recommendation is to remove the entire bladder.
Right.
So the bladder has to do three things. The bladder has to store urine, the bladder has to get rid of urine, and the bladder has to not reabsorb the urine because your body's getting working so hard to get rid of all that stuff that's in your urine.
Yeah.
So with a neobladder, once we've removed the bladder, we need to come up with a way for you to store urine and remove urine. The easiest way to do that is, unfortunately, is to give somebody a bag where the urine drains from.
Right.
So that's the common way. And so something that was developed in the early 1980s, in 1981, I believe, was the first neobladder done. And that was taking a piece of intestine and then disconnecting the intestine from the rest of your body, but keeping it on its own blood supply.
In the same spot, not moving it.
Moving it a couple of inches, but not very far.
Mm-hmm.
And then folding it into a ball and then sewing the ureters, which drain the kidneys, into that ball so that that ball can fill up with urine, and then sewing it to your urine channel so that you can push down and force the urine out. So all of a sudden, we found a way for you to store the urine and get rid of urine.
And this was successful immediately?
There are definitely complications that arise from taking a piece of intestine and filling it with urine, because like I said, one of the jobs of the bladder is to not reabsorb urine, and a neobladder is made of intestine. Intestine's job is to absorb.
Right.
So patients do have a period of time where they really have to recover and they have to get used to the fact that they're going to be reabsorbing some of their urine. It was quite successful and a big step forward.
And I would then suspect that the bladder is not a candidate for a transplant. You could not take this from a cadaver and pop it in somebody who's alive.
No, unfortunately, we can't. And people have tried that. They've also tried scaffolding, where we've genetically created new bladders. In fact, a study was done with that about 5 years ago, where a genetic scaffold for a new bladder was created, almost similar to a transplant. But the bladder was surgically implanted and used. And unfortunately, those patients did not do very well. The scaffold had to be removed in all patients.
What about non-organic materials?
So the bladder, it's this huge muscle that stretches and then contracts. And there is no non-organic material that we have that can really hold the urine and that we're able to squeeze and contract, and that we can sew the ureters to that will allow those to stay open.
Mm-hmm. Our guest today is Dr. Jonah Marshall. Our number here on Medical Monday is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Jeff in Albany. Jeff, you're on.
Hi, I'd like to know the doctor's opinion about a procedure called UroLift. I'd like to know about the safety, the efficacy, and what potential complications to look for.
Okay. Tell us before you do that, what is UroLift?
So the UroLift procedure is a procedure that was designed for the treatment of BPH, which is benign prostatic hypertrophy. That's a condition that's been around since forever. As men age, our prostates get larger.
And
for some men, it blocks the flow of urine, making it hard to pee. So for anybody who's waking up two or three times, four times at night, or finding it hard to get the urine flow, join the crowd. I mean, that's for me, that's job security. Everybody has to deal with this. We've been trying to come up with a great solution for this for millennium. The ancient Egyptians had treatments for enlarged prostate.
Right.
And we're constantly trying to come up with a solution that doesn't have side effects. And so the UroLift is the newest treatment that's been developed. And the idea is that the prostate is blocking the flow of urine and it's closing together so that the urine can't get through the prostate. And the idea of the UroLift is that we're simply pinning the prostate open. So we're not removing any prostatic tissue. We're not affecting the anatomy in any irreversible way. And it's pinning open the prostatic tissue.
And does it work?
We think so. It's been around for 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
And to answer Jeff's questions, there's very little side effect other than some urinary urgency and frequency where it's bothersome for the first couple of months after this is placed in there. And the question is how long is it going to take for the prostate to grow back over top of this procedure that's been done? It looks like in the first few years that we've been using it, that for the vast majority of patients with medium-sized prostates, it works extremely well.
Okay. Jeff, thank you for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. You said a few years. How many years before you're really 100% confident, yeah, this is pretty good?
I'd say somewhere between 5 to 7 years before I'm 100% confident.
You're almost there.
We're getting there.
Our guest today is Dr. Jonah Marshall. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're up.
Do most studies confirm or deny the effectiveness of the use of cranberry juice in the treatment or prevention of urinary tract infections?
Cranberry juice. Okay.
So certainly urinary tract infections is something we see a lot in urology. Many patients come into the office with recurrent urinary tract infections. It's more common in women than in men because women have a shorter urethra. And there are studies about using cranberry juice extract. The whole concept is that the cranberry juice can bind the wall, the lining of the bladder, so that the bacteria can't bind and attach to the bladder. So studies do demonstrate, not all, but some studies have demonstrated that there's a benefit to using drinking cranberry juice or using cranberry juice extract.
All right, Jim, thanks for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jonah Marshall is our guest today from St. Peter's Health Partners. You mentioned, you said BPH it is?
Okay. I didn't.
What about prostate cancer? What are the latest developments?
So prostate cancer is a disease that's extremely common. It's the second most common cancer in men, and we see a lot of prostate cancer. We've certainly learned a lot about prostate cancer over the last 5 to 10 years, understanding that even though about 240,000 people will be diagnosed with prostate cancer, which is a huge number, about 1 in 6 men, many of those people that are diagnosed with prostate cancer will actually have slow-growing prostate cancer that is not going to spread outside of the prostate. They're unlikely to die from their prostate cancer.
Why is it less likely to spread than other forms of cancer?
So it's more that the prostate cancer, it's very heterogeneous. So, and we just have a difficult time as physicians identifying who's going to be at risk for having the aggressive prostate cancer versus who's going to have the prostate cancer that grows quite slowly. So in understanding who's at risk for having the more aggressive prostate cancers, as we're starting to be able to do now with genetic phenotypes, being able to look at genetic mutations, we can determine who's going to be more at risk. So it's more that we don't know, but we're unable to discern which of the different types of cancers you have.
Now, you are a proponent of robotic surgery. What sort of surgery will you do robotically for prostate cancer?
So it's a robotic radical prostatectomy. So for somebody who has a slow-growing, low-risk prostate cancer, I generally recommend just watching it, continuing to follow it, and making sure that it does not progress. But for somebody with an intermediate or high-risk prostate cancer, the treatment is to remove the prostate. Now, the prostate's necessary for reproduction. So if you're not of reproductive age, you don't want to have any more kids, you can remove your prostate.
Right.
The trick is that it's in a very difficult location. It's next to the bladder. It's next to the rectum. It's in a challenging spot. And so you want to use very fine instruments. So that's where the magnification of the robot, the insufflation that decreases the blood loss of the robot, and the very fine instrumentations that we have really help us. The big side effect of removing the prostate is, unfortunately, erectile dysfunction. And with the robot, we're really able to see well where those nerves are. And if you have a very experienced surgeon, they're able to do a very nice nerve-sparing procedure to preserve the nerve vascular bundles so patients don't have side effects associated with surgery.
When you use robots in surgery of any kind, how do you go about making sure these devices are sterilized?
So each of the – I mean, you got some great questions.
Really? That's because I don't know much about anything.
Each of the instruments gets down and is processed individually. Everything is sterilized the way that every scissors is sterilized, every clamp is sterilized in the operating room. So everything goes through a big sterilization process. It all has to be carefully cleaned immediately after it's used and then sent down to our material processing department, which we have in the basement of our hospital. We've got a team there that is absolutely meticulous about making sure all the instruments are appropriately cleaned, fully sterilized, and then ready for the next surgery.
How do you do it? UVs, or what do you use?
They go through an autoclave.
Yeah.
First, they go through an antibacterial solution. They're rinsed completely, and then they're autoclaved. So they're under high heat and temperature, as well as pressure, and that's able to kill all the bacteria.
Our guest today is Dr. Jonah Marshall from St. Peter's Health Partners. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Jim in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Jim, you're up.
Yes, thank you for taking the call. This is for the doctor. This is a follow-up kind of question relating to the UroLift procedure. I had the procedure a couple of years ago, and it actually has been pretty effective. You know, it has increased my urinary flow, and I don't wake up as much at night. The only question that I wanted to follow up with is that when I do wake up at night, like instead of, you know, three times a night, I might wake up once, sometimes twice. But when I do go to urinate during the evening when I wake up, I will urinate, and then like 5 minutes, my bladder is not completely emptied. Like 5 minutes later, I will have to do like stage two of my urination, and then sometimes even the stage three during that one session of waking up. And I'm thinking that this is not necessarily a prostate problem, but this may be a bladder problem, and maybe my bladder is not maybe pumping completely to capacity, thereby emptying my bladder fully, you know, when I first urinate in the evening. So it, you know what I mean? You know what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah. Well, he's asking you, doctor, not me.
Thanks, Ray.
Sure.
So, Jim, thanks for that question. And I think that, you know, that brings up a good question about how the bladder works. So the way that the bladder works is that the bladder contracts. It's this big muscle that's contracting, and it's pushing urine through the prostate and out through the urethra. For some patients who've had a BPH and have had an enlarged prostate, and their bladder's been working hard over a number of years, parts of the bladder can actually develop a weakness, and you can get a part of the bladder muscle that actually blows out and creates another reservoir, which is called the bladder diverticulum. In that case, that can fill up with urine, and when the bladder is contracting, it's forcing urine out through the urethra, but also some of the urine goes into the bladder diverticulum. And so in that case, that part of the bladder doesn't actually empty all the way, and so urine will travel, after you finish urinating, it'll travel back into the bladder, and then you feel like you have to urinate again. So that's certainly one possible explanation for things that could happen, or it could just be that there's a little bit of urine inside the prostate that's irritating it and making it feel like you have to really urinate.
Okay. So like for example, if I wake up once, I may, you know, have to urinate three times, like 5 minutes apart. I think you've answered the question. Is there a treatment for that? If there is this reservoir diverticulum situation, I'm just wondering if there's any kind of treatment that you know of to resolve this particular problem.
Yeah, certainly I can't make any diagnoses over the radio. And
good plan.
Right.
The best thing to do is to see your urologist and have them do a full evaluation, and then they can look at it, come up with the exact diagnosis, figure out exactly what's wrong, and then determine the right path. But yes, there are treatment options for that.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Thank you very much.
Are some of those treatment options surgical? In other words, would you go in and suture close that extra pouch that opens?
Absolutely. And it's easily done with the robot.
Hmm. And you work on kidneys as well with the robot.
I do. So another common malignancy that we see in the urinary tract is a kidney tumor. And it used to be when we found tumors in the kidneys, the treatment is just to remove a kidney.
Right.
Because you can live on one kidney. People do fine just on one kidney. But what we're finding out is that for patients who are able to preserve their kidney, they do better. They have a lower chance of high blood pressure, a lower chance of long-term chance of kidney failure, and their overall long-term mortality rates are better. Mm-hmm. So the new recommendations in the last 10 years have been that anytime that we can do a nephron-sparing procedure, sparing some of the kidney, that it's recommended that we do that.
Some. In other words, you can take half a kidney away and still be all right?
We can.
Interesting. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Learning a lot today with Dr. Jonah Marshall of St. Peter's Health Partners. Let's go over to Kathy in Seward, New York. Kathy, you're up.
Hi. Just heard this gentleman speaking of waking up and urinating and then realizing 2 minutes later that he still has to urinate. And you were kind of ascribing it a little bit to prostate issues, but I have that same issue. So can women get this, what did you call it, diverticulated bladder?
So certainly women can get a bladder diverticulum, although there are a lot of reasons that people will continue to have the urgency or feel the need to urinate. And while I was saying that was one possible explanation, it's certainly not the only explanation.
Right.
So for people that have the urge to urinate, it can come from a number of things. So it's difficult to say whether or not it's from the bladder not emptying completely. So there can be an obstruction that leads to the bladder not emptying completely, or if it's from an overactive bladder where the nerves to the bladder are constantly telling your bladder that you need to contract and to urinate.
But, I mean, if you actually urinate, I mean, that's not just the nerves.
So certainly if you're not emptying the bladder all the way and there's a little bit of urine left over, you can continue to go over and over. And every 2 to 3 minutes, your kidneys are sending additional urine down through the ureters. So your bladder, every minute of every day, is continuing to fill up.
Okay. All right. Well, it's something I guess I'll have to look into, see what's going on.
Yeah. As with all things, if you're having these symptoms and if they're bothersome, I certainly recommend that you talk to your primary care physician, make sure that you don't have an infection, make sure that there's nothing that's immediately wrong, and then if they feel that it's appropriate, they can refer you over to a urologist.
Okay. Thank you.
And, of course, it could be indicative of a different problem, like diabetes, for instance, right?
Absolutely.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Jonah Marshall, a 40-year listener to the station, first time on the program, and quite possibly the last, but we'll find out. I don't know. He seems to be enjoying himself. Let's take a break, Zach the engineer. 800-348-2551. Home stretch coming up. Medical Monday, and we discuss all things urination with Dr. Jonah Marshall from St. Peter's Hospital Health Partners. Actually, you know what? That's just part of what you do. You do all sorts of urologic surgery and neobladders and whatnot. This email came in, Doctor, from someone whose name is not here at all. This unnamed person writes, how does a person with neobladder know when it's time to urinate or if the ball is too full? I assume they don't get the signal that an actual bladder conveys.
So that is a great question. It's one of the things that I find amazing is that you can create this reservoir that fills up with urine, and patients really do have a sensation of fullness when it starts to get distended.
How do they do that?
I don't know.
It's a mystery?
I mean, patients will tell you that they feel something, they feel a discomfort, and they know when it's full. Although it's something, you know, when you have the urge to urinate, you could say, all right, I'm going to go pee.
Yeah.
And you could say, you know what, this is not a convenient time. I'm in the middle of a show. I can't get up and just walk away. So you can wait and hold off, and you can delay it. But patients with a neobladder really have to be careful that they don't want to delay it too long because they can overstretch the neobladder, which is not true with your native bladder. So all the patients that I treat and perform your neobladder surgery on, it is extremely important that within 4 hours they go and empty their bladder.
Isn't that a flaw? In other words, can't you make a 2.0 version of this neobladder, which will be longer lasting and, you don't have to be on that clock all the time?
It is. I wish I had a better solution. And we're constantly working on that. We have made some improvements. We've recently had a new procedure that we've started doing where we're able to spare a portion of the prostate when we remove the neobladder, so patients no longer have the same difficulties that they did with erectile dysfunction.
Right.
And the other problem with the neobladder is when you're sleeping at night, you're in deep sleep, the muscles relax.
Yeah.
And patients have incontinence at night. With this NeoBladder 2.0 or this prostate-sparing NeoBladder, patients actually do much better with nocturnal incontinence.
Dr. Jonah Marshall is our guest on Medical Monday, and let's hit the home stretch here on the calls. 800-348-2551 is the number. Kevin in Albany. Kevin.
Yes. Hello. This is a really interesting and fascinating show. I have recently been diagnosed with BPH. I had a bladder cancer that was removed several years ago. Everything seems to be fine, but my bladder or my prostate is enlarged. I went from a 1.5 PSA to now a 3.4. And in recent consultation with my urologist, he told me to get a free and clear, I believe he said, PSA to find out, you know, more information about my prostate. My question is, could the PSA have anything to do with the enlargement of my prostate?
Before you start, for those who don't know, PSA is.
So, yeah, Kevin, I'm glad that you called because I'm sure a lot of people have questions about this. So PSA stands for prostate-specific antigen.
Okay.
And prostate-specific antigen is this protein, and the levels are extremely high inside your prostate, and they're supposed to be low in your bloodstream. As we age, the normal aging process, our prostate grows and it develops and creates more and more PSA, more of it leaks into the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. But there's certain things that can cause your bloodstream PSA levels to increase. One of those is an infection. One of those is trauma. So any type of trauma to your prostate, if you've had a recent catheterization or recent procedures, or a horse kicks you in your prostate, which is awful. Or another one is a...
Really? Does that happen?
Never.
Okay.
Never.
All right. All right.
But I think everybody gets my drift here.
All right, fine.
Prostate's cancer. So with prostate cancer, the cancer is growing out of control and it leaks more PSA into the bloodstream. So the PSA, I believe, has really gotten a bad rap because it's not a perfect blood test for cancer. However, it is a good screening test. So for people that have the PSA that is rising faster than is normally expected, this is a great way for us to determine who should be further investigated for a possibility of prostate cancer. So you said your PSA jumped from 1.5 to 3.5, something like that, I believe you said.
Over the last two and a half, three years.
So that's a rise in PSA that's higher than we would expect normally. Certainly, it could be related to your bladder cancer treatments. But in prostate cancer, what the prostate cancer does is you've got free PSA floating around in your body and then PSA that's bound up to proteins. And so there's the stuff that's bound to the proteins, so there's the part that's free. With the cancer, it pulls up a lot of the free PSA that's floating around. So if you have prostate cancer, your free PSA will drop. So in patients where we're looking at a PSA that's risen and we want to know, are these people more likely to have prostate cancer, we're looking to see if their free PSA has dropped. So that's why he's asking.
Kevin, thanks for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jonah Marshall of St. Peter's Health Partners here with us today. And John in Latham. John, you're up.
Great show, guys. I've got a question specifically. My wife was diagnosed with high-grade bladder cancer 2 years ago, and to date, she has not been successful with three different treatments. And at this point, the doctor wants to remove the bladder, and she does not want to remove the bladder. And my question is, are there any other treatments either available now or coming down the line that may work for her?
So, John, first of all, let me say that I'm sorry that your wife is having to go through all of this. With bladder cancer, there's low-grade bladder cancer, which is a slow-growing bladder cancer that's more of a nuisance. Certainly, it's not something that we like, but it's unlikely to spread outside of the bladder. And then there's high-grade bladder cancer, which is a much more serious issue. And with the high-grade bladder cancer, we often try to use immunotherapy, where we put different types of in our case, we're actually putting bacteria in the bladder to stimulate the immune system to fight off the bladder cancer. But if that's not working and the high-grade bladder cancer keeps coming back, yes, the gold standard treatment is to remove the bladder because there's a high risk of it returning. So while there are a bunch of studies that are ongoing looking at other types of immunotherapy to prevent bladder cancer recurrence, I think that... I don't know of any studies that your wife would immediately qualify off the top of my head, but I think it's important that you talk to her urologist and find out if there's any other way to avoid. However, somebody with recurrent high-grade bladder cancer, the best chances at long-term survival are bladder removal.
All right, John, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. Over to Lenox, Massachusetts. Andrew, you're on.
Hi, Jonah Marshall. It's Andrew Kaletsis. I just want to call you and thank you so much for saving my kidney.
Ah.
And I'm so sorry that we couldn't keep you in our neighborhood and that you had to leave to a brighter area. You know, I really miss you.
Well, that's such a nice thing to say.
Thanks for the call, Andrew.
Thanks, man. We appreciate it very much. So you saved his kidney. Hey, good work. You're a humble man. Let's go to Donna in Northville. Donna, you're on.
Hello. My question is about urinary tract infections. I'm taking a medication that does cause UTIs in 22% of patients. And I'm wondering if the doctor has any experience with or information about taking D-mannose to prevent those urinary tract infections.
Taking what?
So D-mannose. So Donna, thanks for the call. You know, like I mentioned before, in urology, we see a lot of patients with recurrent urinary tract infections. And one of the prior callers had asked about the use of cranberry to help prevent urinary tract infections. D-mannose is another medication that's been developed to try to prevent urinary tract infections. And again, it reestablishes the lining of the bladder to prevent bacteria from adhering to the bladder. The studies are decent, not great, but decent.
No, what do you mean decent but not great?
Not all studies have confirmed that D-mannose, much like not all studies have confirmed that cranberry extract prevents recurrent urinary tract infections, but there's almost no downside to using it. And for patients with recurrent infections, we try it. Another treatment is to try to acidify the urine, something called methanamine to help acidify the urine so you don't get recurrent infections. This is something that in the urology clinic we deal with quite frequently, and I think it's probably worth trying.
So infections then need an alkaline environment to live? Is that what you're saying?
So if you can change the pH in the bladder one way or the other, then you can create an environment that the bacteria can't live in.
So in other words, the middle ground being, is it zero or seven?
No, seven.
Seven is the middle ground. That's where you want to be.
So it certainly varies. So there's certain bacteria that prefer more acidic or more alkaline environment. And the question is trying to identify, you know, every person's got a slightly different pH in their urine, and it depends on a number of things. I mean, your urine pH changes day to day depending on what you're eating and drinking.
Right.
In certain cases, changing the pH of your urine can change the environment so that bacteria have a difficult time surviving.
Dr. Jonah Marshall is our guest today. The number is 800-348-2551 on this Medical Monday, and we'll go to Martha in Albany. Martha.
Hello.
Hello.
I appreciate the timing is perfect. I recently saw my GP, and I casually mentioned to her that I don't have an urge to urinate. She said the possibility could be a problem.
We lost you for a second, what? Martha. Say it again. We lost you right where you thought what the possibility was.
Possibility of a prolapsed bladder. If that is the case, how is that treated? Or are there other options, possibilities, causing the lack of the urge to go?
So there's a number of possible explanations for a lack of an urge to urinate. Certainly, I think it's worth doing a full physical, seeing your GP or being referred to a urologist for a full physical examination, getting the urine checked, doing a simple test to see whether or not you're emptying your bladder completely.
How would you do that test?
A tiny little ultrasound that we use in the office. It takes 2 seconds, and we just aim it at your bladder after you've urinated. And in a healthy 18-year-old, your post-void residual or how much urine is left over after you urinate should go to zero.
Ah, okay.
And you can have a prolapsed bladder, so the muscle walls, particularly after childbirth, the muscle walls and the pelvis can weaken, the bladder can drop down, and that does change your sensation when you have to urinate. And that is something that can be treated generally with
Thank
surgery.
Thank you.
Sure.
With surgery, but not medication.
not with medications. Normally we treat it with surgery, but there are other non-surgical treatments for it as well.
Speaking of medication, I watch a lot of late night TV, and for old people, the old person channel, the you know, the old 70s shows, and you'll see a lot of ads. Hey, gentlemen, you got the enlarged prostate? Try X, Y, and Z medication. This is not FDA approved, but it fixes it all. Some of these over-the-counter things, snake oil, real, any chance?
So most of the over-the-counter drugs that are out there are all based on salt palmetto.
Yeah.
And if you look at the ingredients carefully on almost all of these prostate medications, salt palmetto is the number one ingredient in them. And salt palmetto is an interesting drug. There was a very large placebo-controlled, double-blinded study looking at whether or not salt palmetto works.
Yeah.
And it showed that it was no different from placebo.
Ah.
However, I have patients that swear by it. I have family members that swear by it. So I'm pretty sure that there are some people where it works and that overall as a population, it just doesn't work on everybody.
Wouldn't that pop up in the scientific testing, though?
Not if the population that's affected is small enough that it's no different than placebo. Mm,
okay. Our guest is Dr. Jonah Marshall, and let's get back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Brian in Red Hook. Brian, you're up.
Hey, how you doing, Dr. Marshall? I appreciate you taking my call. I'm a 46-year-old male, and I had blood in my urine a couple of years back, so I started going to the urologist, wanted to rule out bladder cancer. They scoped me and found everything to be fine, but I'm still urinating 3 to 4 times a night, and I don't know what's going on with that.
So, is your question, why are you urinating frequently?
Why am I urinating so much? And wouldn't it just be general practice of a urologist? Like, do I have to ask to have my prostate checked? I don't understand. Like, I didn't go to medical school. I'm not the one who knows how the body works. And I'm finding it very difficult to get myself patched up so I can carry on with my life.
Okay.
Yeah. So I understand, you know, certainly it's disconcerting to have blood in the urine, and part of that workup is to evaluate the bladder, to look in the bladder and do some imaging studies and look. And that's important for everybody that's got blood in the urine because we want to make sure that somebody doesn't have any signs or any evidence of malignancy. So that's our number one goal, is to make sure there's no malignancy. And then if you're having other symptoms, waking up frequently, certainly it's something that I would talk to your urologist about. Bring it to their attention, because sometimes if people are focused on one problem, they may lose sight of the other issues. And having an annual prostate check is part of the screening test for prostate cancer, which I recommend that everybody have once a year, whether it's by your primary care physician or your urologist.
All right, Brian, thanks for the call and good luck. We now go to Bob in Albany. Bob.
Hello. My question is whether there's a connection between UTIs and vertigo, which is what I've been hearing from some non-physician medical practitioners. Does UTIs lead, particularly in women, to vertigo on occasion?
So, Bob, to my knowledge, there is no connection between the two.
Interesting. I mean, inner ear, yeah. Right?
Right, so
I wouldn't have expected it. I was just hearing that from some, you know, licensed practitioners, but not physicians.
Hmm.
So, but you don't see anything to that.
Hmm.
Not as far as I know, although, you know, when those things come up, if you don't have an answer in Western medicine, maybe there's an answer somewhere else.
Interesting. Bob, that was a very interesting call. Thank you very much. Let's go to John and Troy. John, you're on.
Hi. Regarding the two people earlier who were getting up all the time to go pee in the middle of the night,
yeah.
The man and the woman who both called,
mm-hmm.
I've had the same problem for a while, and my urologist started me on Tamsulosin, which is one of those medications that I think helped tremendously. I haven't had the urge nearly as often since I started taking that. And interestingly enough, my mother, who is prone to UTIs, and she's in her mid-80s, she was prescribed the same medication. That seems to be helping her as well.
What's the medication?
So I wondered if you had any comment on that.
Yeah, so John, thanks for bringing that up. So tamsulosin is one of the mainstays of treatment for BPH.
Yeah.
And it's something that we use all the time, and we also use it in women as well if they're not doing a job fully emptying the bladder. What it does is it relaxes the smooth muscle around the prostate, so it takes the tension off of the urethra so the urine can flow through, and it works within 12 to 24 hours and maximal effect within 7 days. It's better known by its trademark name, Flomax.
Oh, you see the commercials with the guys in the convertibles, right?
Absolutely, and it works great.
Well, if that works on the prostate, how would that work in women?
It relaxes the smooth muscle around the bladder neck to let the urine out a little bit more easily.
And what are the side effects?
You can get some postural hypotension if you stand up too quickly. You can get
like
some
vertigo.
I suppose it could present as vertigo. I think you're onto something here, Ray.
Oh, this is very interesting. Well, we'll have to have you back for a future show, and we'll discuss our investigation into this quickly now. Only about 15 seconds. Steve in Huntington, you're on.
Hi, I'm a 70-year-old guy with mild hypertension, so I try to limit my sodium in my diet. But on days that I, you know, maybe have a pizza or some high-sodium food, it seems as though I have to urinate a real lot more often at night.
Okay.
Does that make sense, that the sodium would increase the need to urinate at night?
Yeah, it sure does. So that's another point. So the kidneys are constantly part of our excretory system. If your sodium levels are up, our kidneys are trying to get rid of the extra sodium, and that's one of the reasons you may be urinating more.
All right, Dr. Jonah Marshall, did you have fun?
I did, Ray. Thanks for inviting me on.
And we'll have you back on the program if you choose to accept the challenge. Support comes from Nuvance Health. HealthQuest and Western Connecticut Health Network are now Nuvance Health, working together to rethink the healthcare experience and deliver care with patients in mind. NuvanceHealth.org. Thanks again to Dr. Jonah Marshall of St. Peter's Health Partners for being here. Thank you for listening. Humble apologies to all those left on the line. You should have called earlier, but he'll be back. Thanks again, and thanks to Zach, our engineer. Well done. Kayleen White answered the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on a program, oh, forget about it. Rich Guthrie comes back to the studio, and he'll talk about birds. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.